Chapter 6. Lucrative Lobbying. What the Rich Can Do for the Gangs. You gotta hand it to Jack Abramoff. Back in 2006, the super lobbyist pled guilty to fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials in what some called the biggest congressional scandal in more than a century. Two Bush White House officials got convicted in the scandal, along with U.S. Representative Bob Ney and nine more lobbyists and staffers in Congress. Now, Abramoff is out of jail. He just came out with a book called Capital Punishment and is making the rounds of the talk shows and even visiting Ralph Nader's office to take questions from campaign finance reform activists. Casino Jack Whistleblower? Well, he certainly seems willing to give some inside information on how the lobbying looters operate. I use that term for good reason because Abramoff himself has coined the phrase lobbyist safecracker method. He described in one interview how he was working for a big D.C. law firm, Greenberg Traurig, which got hired by special interest groups to push for or against specific legislation. That's what lobbying is, though it's often called government relations. But then again, you could also call it legalized bribery. One of Abramoff's clients was the multinational Tyco International Corporation, which in 2003 gave his firm $1.3 million to twist arms in Congress. They were fighting to stay out of the tax bill that year, which would have retroactively taxed them to the tune of about $4 billion, Abramoff recalled. The bill, introduced by Iowa's Republican Senator Charles Grassley, had a provision that targeted outfits like Tyco, which claimed an offshore tax status. So Abramoff got everybody and their brother to make contributions to Grassley's re-election campaign. That's the lobbyist safecracker method, is raise money and become a big donor. One of his team members started doing some morning jogging with the senator. Abramoff's company held a fundraising event for him. Eventually, although Grassley himself wasn't the culprit, the provision Tyco was worried about got dumped from the bill. What lobbying was really all about, Abramoff recalls, was becoming friends with our legislative gang members and giving them a stream of goodies that led to an ability to ask them back for a stream of goodies the other way. Those offered goodies included stock tips, skybox tickets to pro football games, lavish restaurant meals, and feather bedding, which is defined as making lucrative job offers to chiefs of staff in Congress. I started to notice pretty quickly that the second I said that to them, they were so incredibly complimented that from then on anything I asked was just absolutely granted. As the word got out, it seemed 90% of the people I dealt with up there wanted to come work for me. In a year or 6 months, but from that entire period of time, they really worked with me anyway. That was an incredible way to control a congressional office. Abramoff told the crowd at Nader's Public Citizen Organization, I was involved deeply in a system of bribery, legalized bribery for the most part, illegal bribery, unfortunately, for me, somewhat, and that system, which I took advantage of, which I also took for granted, as do many who are still in it, still to a large part exists today. In case anyone's interested in asking, Eye-to-Eye Strategies is helping Casino Jack book speaking engagements at a going rate of between $15,000 and $25,000 per event. Like he says, that's necessary because I owe $44 million in restitution. Besides which, he says he'd really like to change the system, and none of the candidates, including Obama, is talking about real reform anymore. When you've got Jack Abramoff as the voice of reform, do you think maybe it's time to think about changing the game? For lobbying, all told, 30 big corporations spent almost $500 million over a 3-year period between 2008 and 2010. That's about $400,000 each day, including weekends. Those same companies had combined profits of $164 billion and tax rebates of nearly $11 billion. They paid more to lobby Congress than they paid in federal income taxes. Think there's any tie in there? Like Abramoff, a few congressfolk do get caught with their fingers in the cookie jar. The most notorious in recent years was Randy Duke Cunningham, a Republican representative from the San Diego area. He served on the House subcommittee that provided the funding for the Pentagon. On a note card in his office, starkly framed under the congressional seal, the Duke had a bribe menu. It listed an escalating scale for bribes, starting at $140,000 and a luxury yacht for a $16 million Defense Department contract. Each additional $1 million in contract value required a $50,000 bribe. The rate dropped to $25,000 per additional million once the contract went above $20 million. At one point, Cunningham was living on a yacht named after him, the Dukester, docked near Capitol Hill, courtesy of a defense company president. One outfit alone, MZM Incorporated, gave Cunningham over $1 million in cash, cars, and antiques in exchange for $150 million plus in business. The Dukester ended up in the dumper. He's still serving out a 100-month jail sentence and has become an advocate for prison reform. On the other side of the aisle, Louisiana Democrat Representative William Jefferson got sentenced to 13 years in 2009 after being charged with bribery, racketeering, and money laundering. Over a 5-year period, Jefferson had gone to a dozen mostly African companies involved in oil, sugar, communications, and more, saying he'd promote their ventures through the trade subcommittee in exchange for millions in his pocket. He turned out to be a fan of veggie burgers. The FBI found $90,000 of cold cash inside veggie burger boxes in Jefferson's home freezer, all neatly wrapped inside aluminum foil. Just call him the Where's the Beef Bandit. This sentence should be a clear signal that our society will not tolerate bribery. It's not just another cost of doing business in government, said U.S. Attorney Neil H. McBride after the verdict. Uh-huh. We've come a long way from John Adams pointing out that paying a reasonable salary to our elected officials was one of the best securities of liberty and equality. Today we're a government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich. Consider this. If you were elected today to the U.S. House or Senate, the job itself pays $174,000 a year, more than most people make, but still not outrageous. But a 2009 study by the Center for Responsive Politics, would that we had such, uncovered that 261 of the 535 members of Congress were millionaires, and that's without being required to report their homes as assets. The median income of our legislators was $911,000, and in the Senate alone was $2.38 million. As one op-ed writer put it, this is not too shabby when the median household income in America is roughly $50,000. In short, our federal lawmakers are 9 times richer than the other Americans. At the top of the heap is Republican Representative Daryl Issa from Southern California with a net worth that's topped out at $700,850,000. He's chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, the dude who asked 150 businesses and trade groups to identify overly burdensome regulations that he could try to kill. Since he got elected to Congress in 2000, an expose in the New York Times revealed that he's bought up office buildings, split a holding company into separate multi-billion-dollar businesses, started an insurance company, traded hundreds of millions of dollars in securities, invested in overseas funds, retained an interest in his auto alarm company, and built up a family foundation. He has secured millions of dollars in congressional earmarks for roadwork and public works projects that promise improved traffic and other benefits to the many commercial properties he owns north of San Diego. It is sometimes difficult to separate the business of Congress from the business of Daryl Issa. What's that panel he chairs again? Of course, the House Overload and Government Refill Committee. Coming in second behind Issa in the richest person in Congress sweepstakes is Michael McCaul of Texas, Republican, $502,205,003, followed by Jane Harman, Democrat, $493,604,000, Mark Warner, Democrat, $309,088,999, and John Kerry, Democrat, $281,976,067. What about the candidates for president? The richest by far is Mitt Romney, whose fortune is around $250 million. Among the other early Republican contenders, John Huntsman Jr., whose daddy owns a global chemical company, is worth $70.3 million, and Newt Gingrich, $30.6 million. Also, solidly in the top 1% is Herman Cain, with earnings of over $1.2 million a year, and Rick Santorum, and more than $700,000 in 2010. Of course, Barack Obama's right up there, too, thanks mostly to sales of his books, with $11.8 million in assets. But even if you're not among the top 1% while serving your gang, I mean country, there's plenty of opportunity later on. A study released in September 2011 found that close to 400 of our ex-lawmakers have made the jump to nearby K Street, where the lobby lizards await. I mean, they don't have to actually make new friends, right? Influence Peddlers United could be their slogan. A former member of the House or Senate, with even modest seniority, can now expect to walk into a job paying up to $1 million or more a year, and much more when bonuses were paid for bringing in new clients, writes Thomas B. Edsel, author of The Age of Austerity. The record setter for ex-members was Louisiana's Republican representative, Billy Tausen, who made over $11.5 million in 2010 running the big lobbying arm for the drug industry, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. But it turns out that the top four lobbying buckaroos on a list of the most influential are all former Democrats. John Breaux of Louisiana, who served in Congress from 1972 to 2005, has a company called the Breaux Lott Leadership Group, a subsidiary of Patton Boggs LLP law firm, which raked in billings of $11.83 million in 2010 from such clients as Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, General Electric, AT&T, Tyson Foods, and the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. Breaux once famously said to reporters, "My vote can't be bought, but it can be rented." Another case in point, Dick Gephardt, who represented a working-class district in Missouri for years and rose to become House Majority Leader, started the Gephardt Government Affairs Group in 2007. With clients that include Boeing, paying them $440,000, Waste Management, $320,000, Visa, $200,000, Goldman Sachs, $200,000, and Ameren Corporation, $200,000, his lobbying company earned nearly $7 million in revenues in 2010. What matters is what the Senate is doing on the payroll tax, not whether some old members of Congress do lobbying, said ex-Representative Tom Downey with a straight face, while his Downey McGrath group reported lobbying income of $3.32 million from such clients as Time Warner Cable, FedEx, the National Association of Chain Drugstores, and the investment bank Lazard Limited. Two more senators joined the lobbying club early in 2011, Republican Robert Bennett and Democrat Brian Dorgan, both becoming part of the Errant Fox LLP. Rules in Congress prohibit former House members from lobbying their ex-colleagues for a year, and senators have a two-year waiting period. But former members can immediately advise clients on how to maneuver the halls of Congress and influence policy before actually registering as lobbyists. Like boss, like employee. A 2011 report by Legistorm, an online disclosure site, found that almost 5,400 ex-congressional staffers moved on from Capitol Hill to be federal lobbyists over the past decade. 25 powerhouse firms and organizations employ 10 or more former Hill workers. The largest number are at the Podesta Group, followed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which employs at least 21. Altogether, about 14,000 people work up there on the Hill, and about 11,700 more are registered to lobby there. It's the old familiar revolving door. In 2010, the London School of Economics reported that 1,113 of those lobbyists used to work in the personal office of one legislator or another. Remember the Congressional Supercommittee debt panel that got established in the summer of 2011 to figure out how to make those huge cuts in federal programs? Well, that supposedly sent K Street into a panic, but not to worry. Nearly 100 registered lobbyists who used to work for members of the Supercommittee are now representing defense companies, healthcare conglomerates, Wall Street banks, and others with a vested interest in the outcome of the panel's work, according to a Washington Post analysis of disclosure data. Three Democrats and three Republicans on the panel also employ former lobbyists on their staffs. Two-thirds of the lobbyists with ties to the Supercommittee are Democrats. Since the Republicans gained control of the House in 2010, almost 100 members of Congress have hired lobbyists as their chiefs of staff or legislative directors, more than ever before. Obama made it a point that his administration wasn't going to hire lobbyists, but it turns out there's a waiver process if you haven't engaged in the practice for 2 years. So Vice President Joe Biden was free to bring on a new counselor, Steve Ricchetti, of the lobby firm burying his name because he stopped doing it in 2008 and since had advised clients on public policy, communication strategy, and grassroots efforts. Where that fine line is, who can say? It's not just politicos at the top who do the revolving door waltz. Walter Lukin, in the later years of Bush's administration, was chief regulator of the commodities markets. He was supposed to spot and combat speculative abuses and manipulations that might have led to artificial price hikes and other disruptions. In 2008, Lukin presided over some of the worst chaos in the commodities markets in recent history. The huge spike in commodity index speculation, which had grown from $13 billion in 2003 to more than $260 billion as of March 2008, was, in Lukin's mindset, not a result of manipulative forces. He's since reaped his reward. Early in 2010, Lukin got named to head the Futures Industry Association, the top lobby group for futures investors. One expert said of the appointment, "It's not the revolving door, it's the express elevator." Perhaps no corporation plays this switching partners game better than the agrochemical biotech giant Monsanto. When their artificial bovine growth hormone, BGH, first got approved for going into milk, Margaret Miller was their person in charge of preparing the report. By the time the report needed government evaluation, she was Deputy Director of Human Safety and Consultative Services in charge of overseeing the process. Then there's Michael R. Taylor. He began as a law partner representing Monsanto on BGH issues. Then he became the FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Policy and wrote the labeling guidelines claiming there was no difference between RGBH and regular milk. He returned to the Monsanto fold for a time, and today Taylor is the Obama administration's food safety issues head honcho. Clarence Thomas used to work for Monsanto, but when the Supreme Court made a recent ruling in favor of their genetically modified alfalfa, Thomas voted aye without a blink. And there's Linda J. Fisher, who was once at the EPA heading their Office of Pollution, Prevention, Pesticides, and Toxic Substances. Monsanto brought her on board to run their lobbying operation, after which she returned to EPA as its number two administrator under George W. Bush. Last year wasn't a banner one for the lobby shops. Due to the lingering slow economy and preoccupation with the debt ceiling discussions that really slowed down traditional legislative work to a crawl, according to the chairman of the Patent Boggs lobbying outfit, Nick Allard, his company was alone in seeing double-digit growth. They had $24.7 million in revenues for the first 6 months of 2011 after their big merger with John Brough's shop. The figures for the clients of these firms are pretty staggering. In 1998, the total spending on lobbying was $1.44 billion. By 2011, that had soared to $3.3 billion. So who's forking out the most cash in terms of influencing our public policy? At the top of the heap among lobbying clients is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which during those 13 years shelled out more than $800 million. The Chamber is the trade association that represents, among others, ExxonMobil and AIG. Their main issues are job-killing regulations, going after government-run health care, and attacking any federal efforts to rein in domestic energy production. And Chamber CEO Tom Donahue is a master at raising funds from the energy, insurance, and pharmaceutical industries and Wall Street firms. The Chamber was created in 1911, a year before the Federal Reserve, and since it's a tax-exempt group, by law it's allowed to keep its donors undisclosed. But some of these have since leaked out. Prudential Financial providing $2 million to weaken the historic rewrite of the nation's financial regulations. Dow Chemical $1.7 million, fighting proposed rules that would impose tighter security requirements on chemical facilities. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, $1 million to support the Chamber's political efforts in 2010. Unnamed health insurance providers who funneled at least $10 million in 2009, all of it anonymously, to oppose President Obama's health care legislation. Other donors to the Chamber include Goldman Sachs, Chevron, Texaco, and Aegon, a multinational insurance company based in Europe. The Chamber geared up for the 2012 election year by running advocacy attack ads in a number of states, primarily targeting Democrats. They are, according to Scott Reed, a Republican operative who is now a senior political strategist for the chamber, engaged in presidential policies and issues as part of our voter education. They use the lobbying firm Hunton & Williams, one of whose attorneys solicited a set of private security firms, collectively called Team Themis, to develop tactics for damaging progressive groups and labor unions. The hacktivist group Anonymous posted emails about this, including a company entrapment project calling for creating a false document, perhaps highlighting periodical financial information that would get passed on to a group opposing the chamber, which would then be exposed as fake and undermine the group's credibility. Coming in second among the big lobbying spenders was General Electric, $282 million. Over the past decade, GE was awarded almost $32 billion in federal contracts, the majority going to their defense and healthcare subsidiaries. At least 8 GE lobbyists used to work for members of the Debt Ceiling Supercommittee, so I wonder what budget cuts they're planning to recommend. Following GE on the client list were the American Medical Association, $254 million, American Hospital Association, $214 million, and Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, $214 million. The Pharma Trade Group also gave $15 million to the Chamber of Commerce in 2008. In 2011, commercial banks spent a record $62 million on lobbying. As a whole, the financial sector spent $472 million. Wells Fargo led the way, followed by Bank of America. Those two had close to 100 meetings with federal agencies over the course of the year. There's also a Financial Services Roundtable, which has been flooding regulators with comment letters on the Dodd-Frank financial reform law that passed in the summer of 2010. Out of 225 rules that were supposed to have taken effect from the legislation so far, more than 70% have missed their deadlines. One of the ways they, the financial industry, win the battle is by attrition, by ensuring that there's so much activity things get delayed, says Nancy Watzman, a consultant with the watchdog Sunlight Foundation. Corporations don't lobby Congress for fun, said NPR's Planet Money blog in 2012. They lobby because it helps their bottom line. Getting a regulation gutted or a tax loophole created means extra cash for the corporation. But getting laws changed can be very expensive. How much money does a corporation get back from investing in a good lobbyist? Economists track the return on investment, ROI, from the American Jobs Creation Act that passed Congress back in 2005. This benefited hundreds of multinational corporations with a huge one-time tax break. Without the law, companies that brought profits earned abroad back to the U.S. had to pay a tax rate of 35%. With the law, that rate dropped to just over 5%. It saved those companies billions of dollars. All told, companies spent $282 million lobbying for that bill to pass and saved a combined $88.6 billion in taxes. The ROI was 22,000%. For every lobbying buck spent, the corporations got $220 in tax benefits. Sure is hard to find a better investment than that. House Speaker John Boehner is a big favorite of these guys. On his way to that position in 2010, he maintained especially tight ties with a circle of lobbyists and former aides representing some of the nation's biggest businesses, including Goldman Sachs, Google, Citigroup, R.J. Reynolds, MillerCoors, and UPS. They have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to his campaigns, provided him with rides in their corporate jets, socialized with him at luxury golf resorts and waterfront bashes, and are now leading fundraising efforts for his Boehner for Speaker campaign, which is soliciting checks of up to $37,800 each, the maximum allowed. That campaign offered donors giving the maximum some special perks, like meetings with Leader Boehner and much, much more. Yum. Is anybody minding the store? Or even calling a timeout? Here's the thing. The Republican candidates for office flat-out place no restrictions whatsoever on taking money from lobbyists. Since the day he announced he was running for president, Obama hasn't accepted a dime from registered lobbyists, says his press secretary. But Democrats under Obama do their courting of lobbyists off-site. For example, at coffeehouse meetings that don't appear on the official White House visitor logs. The Lobbying Disclosure Act, a rather complex piece of legislation, as you might imagine, has rules specifying whether contacts intended to influence a public official are active or direct, rather than routine information-gathering sessions. Lobbying isn't just about getting tax breaks for businesses, though. Foreign countries get into the act as well. Making no bones about what it's after and pulling out all stops to try to get it is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC for short. It employs about 100 people at its headquarters a couple blocks from the Capitol. These guys have been around a long time, and right now, they're pushing like hell for an invasion of Iran. One of this lobbying group's sham charities is the nonprofit American Israel Education Foundation, AIEF, housed in the same building which, in 2011, gave all expenses-paid trips to Israel for 81 members of Congress during the summer recess. That's right, nearly one-fifth of the entire House taking junkets that included a round-trip flight in business class for lawmakers and their spouses, that alone is worth about $8,000, fine hotels and meals, side trips and transportation and guides. The AIEF spent more than $2 million on these junkets, which did not include a look-see at Israeli problem areas, such as the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. In exchange for all the fun and games, the Congress members are expected to sing for their lavish dinners by honoring President Bush's 2007 pledge to provide the Israeli military with $30 billion of taxpayer-funded weapons between 2009 and 2018. It's interesting because, according to the post-Abramoff ethics reform legislation that took effect in 2007, excuse me for gagging, it was called the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act, travel junkets by nonprofits that are controlled and directed by a lobbying entity are supposed to be illegal. AIPAC in 2009 generously contributed more than $3.2 million of employee salaries to cover the staff costs of AIEF. But amazingly enough, AIEF, which raked in more than $26 million in 2009, has no paid employees, not a single one. In 2009, AIEF transferred $13.5 million in tax-deductible funding to AIPAC. The two organizations' directorates are basically interlocking. But wait, there's more. AIPAC, through AIEF, has also been paying Sheldon Adelson, the casino tycoon who's worth almost $25 billion, to help ferry lawmakers and their staff on luxury trips to Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and other locations. In addition to well-known Vegas casinos like the Venetian and Palazzo, Adelson still owns a travel company that operates several private planes. The company is GMV Travel, which received $738,572 in compensation as the travel agent for a number of Congress members in 2005. Adelson, by the way, thinks Palestinians are an invented people, and we should consider military force against Iran. AIPAC has come up with a notion of asks, whereby they go to Capitol Hill basically demanding fealty to Adelson's friend, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, on Palestine or Hamas or Iran or whatever. Congress typically then introduces legislation saying yay to the asks, almost rhymes with ass-kiss. Woe be to those who don't go along. Representative Betty McCollum, a Maine Democrat, wouldn't support a bill that would have essentially banned all U.S. contacts with Palestinians. An AIPAC official from her district then called her a supporter of terrorism and warned that her behavior would not be tolerated. I guess don't ask, just tell is the motto. Besides the freebies doled out by their educational arm, AIPAC excels in the game of political contributions to the two gangs. According to Joel Bienen, a Middle East history professor at Stanford, in the 1970s and 1980s, AIPAC was able to unseat representatives and senators who could not be counted on to support Israel without qualification, such as Senator Charles Percy, Republican, Illinois, Representative Paul Findlay, Republican, Ohio, and Representative Pete McCloskey, Republican, California. In 2002, they successfully targeted African-American reps Earl Hilliard and Cynthia McKinney for defeat in Democratic primaries. AIPAC staff analyzes congressional voting records and shares the results with its members, who can then contribute money to candidates directly or to a network of pro-Israeli political action committees, Between 1990 and 2004, these PACs gave candidates and parties more than $20 million. The AIPAC PACs had cutely innocuous names like Citizens Concerned for the National Interest. And the bottom line is that the United States gives Israel about $3 billion a year in military and economic aid. That comes out to something over $2,000 per U.S. taxpayer. Not a bad return on investment, except for us. It's also about propelling us into another insane war in the Middle East. Just change the last letter of the country name from Iraq to Iran. Like Watergate's Deep Throat once said, follow the money. Sheldon Adelson, the eighth richest person in America, single-handedly kept Newt Gingrich in the Republican race for president by contributing $16.5 million to Newt's super PAC. I'm against very wealthy people attempting to or influencing elections, Adelson said recently, but as long as it's doable, I'm going to do it. In fact, he says he might even give $100 million to Gingrich or some other bloody kinsman. Wouldn't you agree that it's time for a little investigation into what super PACs are all about when it comes to the Our Gang miniseries that's playing out in our living rooms? Chapter 7. Running for Office. Super PAC-Men. The great corporations, which we have grown to speak of rather loosely as trusts, are the creatures of the state. And the state not only has the right to control them, but it is duty-bound to control them wherever the need of such control is shown. Theodore Roosevelt. Back in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt asked Congress in two annual messages to initiate campaign finance reform, saying, "All contributions by corporations to any political committee or for any political purpose should be forbidden by law." The Tillman Act then passed in 1907 and included this statement: "It shall be unlawful for any national bank or any corporation organized by authority of any laws of Congress to make a money contribution in connection with any election to any political office." Almost 100 years later, we've turned that law around by 180 degrees. In 2010, the Supreme Court declared corporations to be legally just like people, the infamous Citizens United decision. Since then, it's now become a free-for-all in terms of buying favors from the two gangs. And in this year's presidential election, it's a fire sale for super PAC-men. I don't know how much you know about the video game, but players steer Pac-Man through a maze which is roamed by four enemies trying to catch him. Near the corners of the maze are flashing dots called power pellets, which Pac-Man can use to eat his enemies. They then turn deep blue, but they can still reverse direction and come at him more slowly. The enemies are called ghosts and monsters. Does this remind anybody of the maze that the candidates can now use to avoid real scrutiny of who's buying them off, while the power pellets keep pouring in and the attack ads they fund keep spewing venom on more enemies? Even though the politicians were always busy looking for loopholes to get more funds for their campaigns, until recently there were some regulatory restraints in place. In terms of context, political action committees, or PACs, are intended to function as organizations aimed at getting a particular candidate elected or advancing some form of policy or legislation. Each state has different laws governing the fundraising capabilities of a PAC, and a PAC supposedly can't be used to finance a run for president. If the PAC functions at the federal level, it can't directly take money from corporations and unions. But if a PAC functions at the state level, and provided that the particular state has laws favorable to these types of donations, then anyone can donate any sum of money to any PAC for any reason. Mitt Romney, for example, received over $100,000 in campaign donations via various state-level PACs, allowing his campaign to skirt around federal campaign finance limits. Individuals have given Romney's personal PAC, Free and Strong America, large sums of money. Richard and Donna Marriott of Marriott Hotels have spread at least $225,000 across PACs located in 5 different states. Edward Conrad, an executive at Bain Capital, a Boston-based private equity firm founded in 1984 by Romney and two others, donated $100,000. Hosheng Ansari, former finance minister of Iran under the Shah, and current chairman of Stewart & Stevenson, a private oil and gas manufacturer based in Texas, contributed $95,000 to Romney's state-level PAC. Beyond that, Romney has also cozied up to David Koch, vice president of Koch Industries, a private conglomerate involved in energy and energy-related manufacturing industry, an underwriter for a variety of conservative causes, including the Tea Party. We'll get to that in a bit. But those sums pale in comparison to what we're seeing now that we've gone from PACs to super PACs. Basically, what the Supreme Court did in 2010 stripped away virtually all the constraints on the activities of corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals with respect to federal elections. The 5-4 decision in Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission used the First Amendment to claim that all limits on expenditures by candidates and independent groups were violations of free speech. A subsequent ruling by D.C. District Court of Appeals said that all limits on contributions to the groups making these expenditures should be null and void. Mitt Romney summed it up at one of his early campaign stops at the Iowa State Fair. Corporations are people, my friend. Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to the people. Where do you think it goes? Whose pockets? Whose pockets? People's pockets. Human beings, my friend. Since corporations are now people, isn't it natural they should have their free speech rights? Our elections, the ones our government has modeled for the world, are a hoax. What other word should we use to describe this year's presidential election, whose outcome will turn on which party's super PACs gets the most generous bribes from billionaires? Asks columnist Robert Scheer. Consider this. Before Citizens United, the most money a single individual could give to a candidate was $2,500, to a PAC, $5,000, to a political party committee, $30,800. With those kinds of rules in place, Howard Dean shocked the world back in 2003 by raising $828,000 in one day over the Internet, averaging $112 per contribution. Dean got 38% of his presidential campaign funds from donations of $200 or less. 4 years later, Barack Obama raised one-third of his record-breaking $745 million from small donors. Of course, the majority of his money came from big contributors at corporations like Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan Chase. This year, Ron Paul has stayed true to what Dean pioneered, raising 39% from small donors. Now the sky's the limit. It's a jungle out there, one that now includes federal PACs and leadership PACs, super PACs aligned with issues and parties and candidates, and so-called nonprofit groups that give freely to super PACs. Super PACs are basically a beefed-up version of candidate campaign committees, but don't have to abide by the same rules. Besides the Democrats' Priorities USA and Mitt Romney's Restore Our Future, they've got catchy names like Make Us Great Again on behalf of Rick Perry, Our Destiny for John Huntsman Jr., Citizens for a Working America for Michelle Bachmann. The plain old PACs were at least monitored in terms of their fundraising and spending. But super PACs raise and spend whatever they choose, with an unlimited ability to lie in order for their candidate to get elected. Technically, the new super PACs aren't supposed to directly coordinate with a candidate in terms of how they spend the money raised from their donors. But come on, they're pretty much run by the candidate's former staffers and consultants. The Restore Our Future backers of Romney by the end of January had raised $36.8 million, a lot of that in seven- and six-figure gifts from multimillionaires and billionaires. These outside groups are raising way more than the candidates directly. In 2000, total campaign contributions to all politicians was $3 billion. 4 years after that, it had reached $4 billion. In the 2008 election, it went up to $5 billion. That was the most expensive election in American history, but 2012 is going to make 2008 seem like chump change. So who are the top honchos among the super PAC givers? As of the end of January 2012, in the lead was a Dallas magnate named Harold Simmons, with a net worth of $9.3 billion, $11.2 million of which he'd donated to candidates in the 2012 race. He started out backing Rick Perry, since the Texas governor had signed legislation that allowed Simmons Company waste control specialists to accept low-level radioactive waste for his $500 million site from outside the state. Perry's Restoring Prosperity Fund got $100,000, as did Romney's Restore Our Future. Whole lot of restoration going on. The super PAC behind Newt Gingrich, winning Our Future, received $1 million. Sounds more like buying Our Future. Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam, net worth $21.5 billion, came out fully behind Newt, with $10 million going to his campaign, fully 84% of the funds for the Gingrich super PAC. Another substantial contribution was said to have been made in February, which would catapult Adelson into the number one spot. Gingrich, when asked what Adelson will get in return for his largesse, said, "Well, he knows I'm very pro-Israel." We looked into Adelson's AIPAC connection in the previous chapter, which Gingrich has since been channeling. Houston home builder Bob Perry, net worth unknown, has put in $3.5 million. Of that, $2.5 million went to Karl Rove's American Crossroads Super PAC. $7 million more came from Perry in 2010, and another mill to Romney's. Back in 2004, Perry was a major funder of the Swift boat ads that smeared John Kerry. He started out backing his namesake, Rick Perry, no relation, and over time had given the governor $2.5 million. Bob Perry's in-house lawyer sits on the Texas Residential Construction Commission, TRCC, that the governor pushed through the legislative process. The TRCC has been dubbed the Home Builder Protection Agency. John Huntsman Sr., net worth $1 billion, was involved in a bit of nepotism. He gave $2.2 million to Our Destiny, the super PAC supporting his son, John Jr. Huntsman the Elder founded a huge corporation that makes and markets chemicals. Jeffrey Katzenberg, net worth $1 billion in 2005, is a film producer and the CEO of DreamWorks Animation. He's forked over $2 million to Priorities USA, the super PAC supporting President Obama. Julian Robertson, net worth $2.4 billion, is considered the godfather of the hedge fund industry, founder of Tiger Management, who's donated $1.25 million to Romney's Restore Our Future. Foster Fries, a mutual fund billionaire, has contributed $1 million to the Rick Santorum Super PAC, the Red, White, and Blue Fund. According to the New York Times, a few of the mega donors gave through limited liability companies, shielding their identity. One $1 million donation to Restore Our Future came from F8 LLC, a company whose listed address in Utah leads to an accounting firm. A charitable foundation linked to Sandra N. Tillotson, co-founder of the skincare company New Skin, uses the same address. Ms. Tillotson was reimbursed by Restore Our Future in July 2011 for what appeared to be costs associated with a fundraiser at her New York apartment. The Supreme Court decision allows corporations to finance political ads that directly support or oppose political candidates and maintain complete anonymity. According to the nonprofit organization's Center for Responsive Politics and Public Citizen, 46% of the outside groups in 2010 didn't disclose any info about their funding, and 66% of donors didn't disclose anything about their campaign ads. The candidates' hands stay clean, while the super PACs do almost all the spending on the attack ads. Mitt Romney did this before the Iowa caucuses, spending $1 million out of his upfront PAC to talk about his work in the private sector, his long marriage, and his devotion to his wife. In the meantime, he outsourced his slams against his then-main rival Newt Gingrich to super PAC supporters from which he could wipe his fingerprints. There's also a whole bumper crop of nonprofit 501c4 social welfare groups, as they prefer to call themselves, set up to donate freely to super PACs. They've got names like Freedom's Watch. Supposedly, they're planning to pour about $240 million into the political arena in 2012. For example, Crossroads GPS is the nonprofit part of the American Crossroads Super PAC started by Karl Rove, and it's the nonprofit that raised $32.6 million in 2011, which was way more than American Crossroads' $18.4 million. Rove's nonprofit has set a goal of raising $300 million this year. The Democrats have Priorities USA and American Bridge 21st Century Foundation as the nonprofits in their apparatus, which raised $5.1 million to the Super PAC's $8.1 million. Bill Moyers recently wrote, "According to the Sunlight Foundation, corporate front groups spent $126 million in the fall of 2010 while hiding the identities of the donors. Another corporate cover group, the American Action Network, spent more than $26 million of undisclosed corporate money in just 6 Senate races and 26 House elections. And Karl Rove's groups, American Crossroads and Crossroads GPS, seized on Citizens United to raise and spend at least $38 million, which the NBC News said came from a small circle of extremely wealthy Wall Street hedge fund and private equity moguls, all determined to water down financial reforms that might prevent another collapse of the financial system. As of August 2011, over 80% of the money in super PACs that back Republican candidates had sprung from a mere 35 people who wrote 6 or 7-figure checks. This was all pioneered by a guy described as Karl Rove's Karl Rove, the Republican strategist Karl Forty, who co-founded the BlackRock Group. There haven't been too many bad days at BlackRock, which advises various outside spending groups on how to win friends and influence politicians. It helps that the Federal Election Commission, FEC, composed of 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats, issued a ruling not long ago that outside spending groups don't have to reveal their donors unless those donors earmark their contributions for specific ads. So, these social welfare nonprofits aren't required to tell the FEC where the bucks are stopping. Some of these haven't even filed their taxes for 2010 yet, so the IRS is clueless about their revenues and expenses. When the IRS came out and threatened to make 5 donors to these kind of groups pay gift taxes, Republican Senator Orrin Hatch wrote a letter questioning whether this action might be politically motivated and violate the First Amendment. So in July 2011, the IRS dropped the audit idea, saying that this is a difficult area with significant legal, administrative, and policy implications with respect to which we have little enforcement authority. So, the gift horses are finding ever more clever ways to break through the starting gate without any accountability. Nobody even knows who wrote the million-dollar check to Romney's super PAC from a company called W-SPAN LLC, which sprang up in March 2011 and dissolved in July, with no listed officers or directors on record. The story on this was headlined, "Perhaps it was the campaign tooth fairy." Supposedly, it's illegal to be a straw donor, people who cover their tracks by giving political money in the name of someone else. It works the other way around. Restore Our Future, for example, has paid Target Point Consulting nearly $350,000 for survey research. Meanwhile, the Romney campaign has paid Target Point nearly $200,000 for direct mail consulting. In one instance, the campaign and the super PAC paid Target Point on the same day. At first, President Obama had called the Supreme Court's decision a major victory for big oil, Wall Street banks, health insurance companies, and the other powerful interests that marshal their power every day in Washington to drown out the voices of everyday Americans. But it wasn't long before Obama's then-press secretary, Bill Burton, announced his intention to start a group to raise unlimited money from undisclosed sources to aid the president's re-election campaign in 2012. After all, they didn't want to cede the advantage to the Republican Party, since Karl Rove and the Koch brothers had formed their own groups to do the same. Last February, the Obama campaign staff sent out an email announcing that they were going to actively solicit as much as they could get for their super PAC, Priorities USA Action. The president has let his campaign manager, Jim Messina, and even members of his cabinet speak at super PAC events. "With so much at stake," Messina wrote on the campaign's blog, "Obama couldn't afford to unilaterally disarm." So much for principles, eh? David Plouffe, Obama's chief political advisor, warned a dozen rich Democrats out in Silicon Valley that the president was threatened by hundreds of millions pledged to defeat him from the Koch brothers and other blood super PACs. "Time to shit or get off the pot," was the message. So Obama has his club of bundlers. No, I didn't say bunglers or burglars. I said bundlers. In case you haven't heard the term before, let me explain. Bundlers, and Obama has 445 of these, whom his campaign calls volunteer fundraisers, gather up the bucks from their rich friends and package it for Obama. Bundlers are not registered as lobbyists, which on paper is a good thing because Obama publicly prohibited lobbyists from contributing to his campaign or holding jobs in his administration. But just like he calls bankers fat cats and then has some of them join him for dinner at a New York restaurant where the tasting menu is $195 apiece, a few cats must have gotten a little fatter that night, there's a difference between what's said and what's done. Bundlers are major fundraisers who both contribute their own money and seek money from others. There is even an exclusive bundling club, the members of which have raised at least $500,000 each. Obama's 2012 campaign has a network of more than 300 of these folks. At least 15 of those bundlers have strong ties to the lobbying industry and had raised more than $5 million for him by the fall of 2011. The New York Times gave the example of Sally Sussman, who leads the powerful lobbying shop for the Pfizer drug maker. A visitor to the White House on four occasions, two of those to talk about export issues, she was a bundling clubber who helped put together a $35,800 ticket dinner for the Prez in New York. There's also David L. Cohen, overseer of lobbying at Comcast, a clubber who hosted 120 people paying $10,000 apiece to barbecue with Obama. So I can't help but point out the hypocrisy here. It's certainly true that Obama built an amazing small donor grassroots base for his 2008 campaign. They had a database of almost 4 million supporters and added 260,000 new donors the first 6 months of 2011. But that March, when Obama brought a bunch of players from the street to the White House to talk informally about financial regulation and the economy, 17 of the 30 guests ended up among his bundler contingent. As Ellen Miller, executive director of the government watchdog Sunlight Foundation, said, "It's high-priced access to closed policy discussions with deep-pocketed individuals, just like it's always been." So by the end of June 2011, 3 months after Obama formally declared he would seek a second term, over 500,000 people had contributed a record-breaking $86 million to his campaign or his joint fund with the Democratic National Committee. The bundlers accounted for at least 40% of that total. By the end of September, another $42 million had been raised from 766,000 donations. Do you think it's just coincidental that one bundling club member, Mark Benioff, chairs a company called Salesforce.com, whose software the Obama administration has adopted for wide use in federal agencies? Here's another way to get around whatever rules and regulations still exist. Ever heard of RGA? That's the Republican Governors Association based in Washington, D.C. During the 2010 midterm elections, the RGA spent $132 million, more than the five biggest conservative super PACs and 501c groups combined, and helped bring in such stellar new governors as Union Buster Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Since 2008, the RGA has used a network of at least 15 state-level PACs to shuffle campaign cash around the country. In Michigan, for example, the Chamber of Commerce officially didn't spend a dime on ads in 2010. Usually it coughed up over $1 million, but it gave over $5 million to the RGA to put out an even bigger outlay. RGA Michigan 2010 suddenly sprang up and brought in bucks from Koch Industries' David Koch, Texas home builder Bob Perry, and a hedge fund CEO named Paul Singer, while it had also funneled $3 million into the campaign coffers of Texas Governor Rick Perry. All in the name of democracy, folks. Remember now, as Mitt Romney said, corporations are people. Since 1990, campaign contributions from the finance, real estate, and insurance sectors of our economy have increased around 8 times. OpenSecrets.org added up that $2.3 billion was spent by those companies between 1990 and 2010. Our Congress today is a forum for legalized bribery, columnist Thomas L. Friedman summed it up. Why are there 61 members on the House Committee on Financial Services? So many congressmen want to be in the position to sell votes to Wall Street. For the 2010 midterms, a whopping $73.8 million went to Democrats and $119.2 million for Republicans. Here are some specific examples of how the bribery scheme worked then. Scott Brown, the freshman Republican senator who took over Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts in 2010, took huge amounts of money from the finance industry while working to stymie a financial regulatory bill. According to the website OpenSecrets.org, General Electric donated around $500,000 to the Obama campaign in 2008. Claiming all profits it reaped were overseas, as I mentioned before, GE didn't pay any taxes in 2010. In the lead-up to the 2010 midterm elections, Ernst & Young held a fundraiser for a little-known Michigan Republican named Dave Camp. He was running virtually unopposed in his district, yet the financial industry showered him with campaign contributions simply because he was expected to take over the House Ways and Means Committee if elected. He won and did. Military contractors, weapons makers such as Lockheed Martin and Boeing, poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into the campaign for Howard McKeon, a Republican from California. McKeon later became chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, Pharma, went the nonprofit route. They're the drug lobby's trade group, and they doled out $9.4 million to social welfare outfits like the American Action Network, a conservative group that poured big bucks into 30-some races and spent over $26 million on political ads, more than anybody else except the Chamber of Commerce. Former Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman, whom I defeated for governor in 1998, was a co-founder of the American Action Network. Today, Coleman is a senior government advisor at Hogan Lovells, one of the lobby shops retained by PHRMA. Doc Hastings, a Republican from Washington State, received big money from the oil and gas companies in the lead-up to midterm 2010 elections. He was successfully reelected and became chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, the one that deals with petroleum conservation. Prior to the election, Hastings blocked a Democrat-sponsored bill that would have enhanced safety standards for offshore drilling in light of the BP oil rig disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. But in case you think BP is getting squelched by the Democrats for having polluted much of the Gulf coastline in the biggest offshore oil spill in American history, it turns out BP is the Pentagon's biggest fuel supplier, their contracts having escalated 33% to hit $1.35 billion in the fiscal 2011 year. That ought to be more than enough to cover the violations of the Clean Water Act, I would think. If not, oh well. BP's total profit in 2011 was $26 billion, a 114% jump from the previous year. They're currently spending millions lobbying the government to speed up more offshore drilling and leases. Before I run out of energy here, let's look deeper at big oil and dirty coal. Since the 1990 election cycle, individuals and PACs affiliated with oil and gas companies have donated $238.7 million to candidates, 75% of that to Republicans. In 2008, Obama received $884,000 from the industry during the presidential campaign, more than anybody else in politics except his opponent, John McCain. In 2011-2012, the top three oil and gas givers were ExxonMobil, $841,644, Koch Industries, $619,900, and Chevron, $445,546. As for nuclear, the Nuclear Energy Institute, the industry's big daddy lobbyist in D.C., spent $3.76 million to lobby the federal government during the last election cycle. Exelon, which owns America's biggest nuclear fleet, contributed almost $515,000 more to the Democrats, 58%, than Republicans. The day after the election, both President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner said the importance of nuclear power was one thing they could agree on. What we've got today is a gang of super-rich Democrats fighting another gang of super-rich Republicans. Would you still call this a democracy? Shouldn't we come right out and admit we're a plutocracy? And shouldn't we call out the two gangs for showing their colors once and for all? And those colors aren't the blue and red of the Crips and Bloods, but rather the green of all our money they are stealing.